Hello, world. It's Mike Traverso with the Friends That Code podcast, where I get a chance to showcase some amazing people I know that just happen to write code for a living. Folks, today I truly have the pleasure of speaking with a groundbreaking developer and game designer. I heard him speak at a conference in 2011 and came away inspired to get making my own games. Getting his start at Atari by creating an impressive port of Pole Position, today's guest has had and continues to have an illustrious career in game development. He's designed and developed games for numerous platforms supporting mediums such as cassettes, cartridges, CD-ROMs, DVDs, iPads, and for the coolest AR experiences to date. Today's guest is very much responsible for helping nudge the industry into the right direction of using discs, namely CD-ROMs, as the medium for games. Creating worlds for players to immerse themselves in is what this man does, and that's exactly what he did with his first title from his first company, Seventh Guest. With Seventh Guest, the first must-have game to be published on CD-ROM, today's guest introduced gamers to pre-rendered 3D scenes, lots of full-motion video to help tell the story, and before this, games were solely told by interacting with sprites or text. A new age of gaming was made possible by the breakthroughs that today's guest and his team made working tirelessly on Seventh Guest. But he doesn't just have one major success. He's had countless others with titles like 11th Hour, Quake 3 Arena, Halo Wars, Doom 2 and 3 being some of the more notable ones. And Doom 3, by the way, scared the hell out of me. He's not just an incredible game designer, developer, producer, but he's also incredibly kind and was a big inspiration to me when I was getting started in mobile development. And I'm over the moon excited to have him as a guest today. Video game lover, developer, designer, producer, godfather of games on CD-ROMs, and man partly responsible for a Christmas shortage of gold Zelda cartridges. Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest is Graham Devine. Graham, thank you so much for hanging out today. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for having me here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's absolutely my pleasure. Graham, we're just going to jump right into it because we've had some issues with getting the podcast going. But, you know, after seeing you speak, I was inspired to create my own game. And it was a memory game that kind of was a cross between Duck Hunt and Simon. And I just wanted to thank you, not just for the inspiration, but for being so kind to me. When I reached out to you via Twitter DM, see, at the time, I didn't understand that you didn't just slide into some legendary game designer's DMs and say, hey, here's a promo code for my game. But you couldn't have been kinder. You wrote me back congratulating me and telling me that you check out the game. And even if you didn't, it didn't matter. Those words were like, they just meant the world to me at the time. And I just want to thank you for your kindness.
Oh, my pleasure. And I really do believe that's important to actually, you know, pay it on. I think that's a big part of my role in the industry these days. So I actually think it's important to do that. But thank you.
And it's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the podcast, because that's a lot of what this podcast tries to do. It tries to help with people, you know, helping folks overcome imposter syndrome by seeing people, not just their career as now, but where they were before, understanding that it's not an overnight thing. And just kind of hearing, you know, great stories from all sorts of developers, designers, and people in tech. But your games have been in my life for a long time. And I didn't realize this until I started doing a lot of the research for the show. So, for example, I really enjoyed Spot for NES, was incredibly frustrated by Silver Surfer, loved Prince of Persia for Game Boy. And I desperately wanted a CDI after seeing Seventh Guest played on a demo reel in a Sears when I was, you know, maybe 13. And I spent way too much time playing Quake 3 Arena in college. And like I mentioned before, Doom 3 really did scare the shit out of me. It was a really intense experience, especially when you play it in a dark room on launch day. So, but I want to, and I'd love to talk about all of those games and more, but I want to focus on Spot and Seventh Guest. And I mentioned in the intro, you were responsible for golden Zelda cartridge shortages. Obviously, I'm kidding about that, but could you tell the story behind that?
Yes, it was. You could actually use the golden Zelda cartridges to burn EEPROMs. And back then, Mastertronic, the company that I worked for, wasn't an official Nintendo developer. So we had hacked the NES to do our bidding for us and written our own assembler. We basically had a photocopy with many coffee stains on it in Japanese, which I don't speak, of the NES manual. And so the only way we could actually program the NES was to program it on our PCs, then burn an EEPROM, and then put that EEPROM into that Gold Zelda cartridge, and then put that Gold Zelda cartridge into the NES. So every morning, we would actually go to Toys R Us and go to that cage and line up with all the moms and dads who are waiting for the Gold Zelda cartridges and try to get some Gold Zelda cartridges to expand our collection of burnable EEPROMs, because you had to actually break one line and then go put the EEPROM in to go to actually do it. So slowly we got up to about 8 or 9 test cartridges that we could actually put spot onto and actually put burnable EEPROMs into. And we cut out the plastic so put the EEPROM into it. And yeah, those were... That was a long debugging cycle where you have to burn EEPROMs. It was lengthy.
Was that, I can imagine, was that kind of the way the industry was then? Or was that kind of like, this is just how Mastertronics did it, and really everybody else was maybe an official vendor of Nintendo? And
at that point, I think the only American company was Acclaim that was doing really official Nintendo development. I think the dam was about to burst. Certainly, Spot became an official Nintendo game and got the license. But the way we got the game done was unofficially, and we continued to use that assembler because it was such a great assembler. It was based upon Lucasfilm's Macross assembler, and so it was, which I'd used at Lucasfilm many years before, written by Chip Morningstar, and that was the basis of the tools going forward at Virgin. So it was still a good system, but yeah, it was interesting way to do things.
Well, I think a lot of, whenever you have new mediums, it tends to be the game designers that kind of end up figuring out how to hack ways forward. I mean, just the fact that you've got to deal with those challenges, but now you're reading the manuals on how to do these things, and it's written in Japanese, and it's probably a bad photocopy, like you said. I mean, it's crazy that Spot was even made it to shelves. Like, so.
And Spot almost got me fired, actually, because I put game credits into Spot. If you play the four AIs together on a harder setting and just play AI versus AI versus AI versus AI, and you play harder setting on them all and watch it play, at the end of that game, it'll play credits in the audience, how they hold up the little cards.
Yeah.
It'll actually play, your game credits. And a tester found that, and I got dragged into the CEO's office. He goes, "You put credits into a game?" Yes. This is after the cartridge was shipped, and it was too late to change anything, because they're basically they're on a boat from wherever on their way over to the USA. and he's like, "That's really serious, Graham. That's you can't do that." No one's going to find it. It's who plays four AIs against each other.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's not a very fun way to do it. And especially back then, that was not the way you play games. I've done that. I've actually done that myself. I haven't gotten fired because no one's found them yet, but I'm waiting for the day. I am going to hook up my Nintendo. Well, I've got my Nintendo, but I'm going to try to find Spot and see if I can do that. And put a screenshot of that in the show notes below.
Excellent.
So let me ask you a question. I know the next game forward was Seventh Guest shortly after that. I know there were a few games maybe in between, but Seventh Guest is really the next big game for you. How do you come to find yourself making Seventh Guest?
Well, after Spot, it was clear Mastertronic was going to focus on cartridges. And Rob Landeros and myself wanted to make something different. We wanted to focus on something larger, something that was just basically not a cartridge. And we were attending the CDI conferences going on at the time. So we went around all these conferences, the multimedia conferences, because CDI was being launched. Encarta was being launched. And all these CD conferences were showing off how fast they could search text. And all Rob and I could do was think, well, no one's thinking how many graphic images you can put on these things. What about the graphics you can stuff on a CD? No one's thinking about that. And so we sat at the airports in New York and wrote on a napkin, literally on a napkin at Kennedy Airport, Clue, Twin Peaks, and a combination of those two things, because Mastertronic owned a Clue license and we loved Twin Peaks, and started to think about the game we wanted to make on CD-ROM.
That's so wild. So wild. And so I haven't played Seventh Guest, but I've seen a lot of videos of it, and it looks really kind of scary, especially for then. I mean, you've got the full motion video on, you know, walking you through the game, and you've got the puzzles and then the little eyeball that kind of follows you around a lot of the time. So that's another game that I need. That is one of your games that I haven't played that I'm definitely looking to try to find a way to get that. But yeah, so that's just a really scary game, it looked like, but a lot of fun.
I just sat through a Twitch stream of someone playing through it, doing commentary on it as they were going through it. And kind of my memories of each of the puzzles and kind of as we came across them. And they were aghast at how horrifying it was. And so was I, actually. Wow, we really made quite the horror game.
Well, did they know that you were there watching along, or?
Oh yes, it was. Okay. They tweeted at me, "Hey, I'm going to be tweeting."
That's cool.
I'm switching the game. You're going to come in, and I'm like, "Yeah, I'm going to comment on that."
That's so cool. I mean, so folks who don't know, you know, like I said, it is a full motion video game. There's a lot of video that kind of walks you through, and if you can remember back then, this was not something that was done. I mean, you had levels that were laid out in front of you and you walked around. If it was, you know, you're dealing with sprites, or if it was text, you interacted with text commands and try to, you know, figure out how to move around. But you didn't have, you know, these 3D rendered worlds that you were walking through, or, you know, videos of characters, you know, that you can not interact with so much, but just that told the story and got you through the game. But looking back on that, you just mentioned, like, nobody was doing this. So I'm going to ask the stupid question here. What is the challenge of making that game that you're incredibly proud of overcoming?
150 kilobytes a second. That's all you get from a 1X CD drive. And when you're running in DOS, you have the MSCD EX extension. And basically, you have two things going on. You can have 150 kilobytes a second and you can write that into a buffer, but you also have to decompress it and get it onto a screen and not have the motor on the CD drive spin down. Right. And so if you're going to play video, you have the challenge of keeping enough data coming from the CD so that the motor won't spin down, and also decompressing the video that's coming in and getting it somehow to the SVGA screen. All of which is in a different video, a different memory bank on the computer than the main memory bank, because back then we didn't have PCI Express lanes. We had, obviously, VESA slots, and we put our graphics cards into VESA slots, and it was not as fast as it is today.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons I wanted to get into game development, is because of all of those challenges back then. And it kind of seems like now a lot of those can kind of be overcome by just slapping in, like, here's you know, 32 gigs of memory, and here's a 3090 graphics card, and, like, let's just go. And you don't really have to deal so much with making sure that you've got clean code and, you know, really no issues with your code. So it kind of reminded me of very much like game development was very much like sending a man to the moon almost. Like, it had to be right. Because again, and that's the other thing that I miss about games, is that when you made games, you would ship them, like you said. And once they shipped, that was it. Like, you paid for a game and that was your game. And now it's you get a game for free and you just, the game lives on kind of forever by buying updates. And so it's not, you know, fans kind of expect more and more out of that game. They don't want, even though it was free, they kind of just want more and more skins, more levels, more everything. So you really need to be making money on all those updates. But okay, I'm going to ask another dumb question, Graham. The $64,000 question, I guess everybody asks, right? What is the future of gaming? Where do you see gaming going?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think it's impossible to keep up where we're at right now. I mean, look at the production values going into Cyberpunk 2077. You know, yeah. I am so looking forward to that game coming out. It's incredible. But look at the production values going into it, how hard it was for them to produce it. How, you know, it was announced in 2014 or whenever. It's a long, long, long cycle, much longer than any movie. You know, I've had three Star Wars movies since that thing was announced. And, you know, four Star Wars movies, including Solo, and a Star Wars TV series, and two seasons of that. And so its production has gotten very complicated to meet the standards that people expect. And at the same time, we just shipped the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X, which is fabulous, awesome devices. So how do we possibly meet the production values that are expected on schedules where we're working with schedules where workloads are just getting more and more intense, and yet at the same time we're still charging $60 for a game, which is what we charged 25 years ago? And I know that it's unpopular to think that we've put more money into games, but games that cost X amount more. And so it's a very, I don't know what's going to give, but something's got to give eventually. We're selling a lot more games, that's for sure. I mean, a game used to sell hundreds of thousands of copies, now sells millions of copies, millions and millions of copies. So the games are still very profitable. So $60 might not need to change. That could be, thankfully, still a good price. It's still a lot of money these days.
Yeah.
But something has to give that allows production of games to become something else. And I'm not sure what that is. I think also it's clear that as infrastructure changes, that the thin infrastructure is going to become more and more important, that the Xbox Series X and the PlayStation 5 might be the last big, powerful GPUs that we see in people's houses. In Stadia, Xbox Cloud, Luna, GeForce Experience, all these things are going to start taking off. Latency is on the way down, and that is going to start to make a difference, I think.
Yeah, cool. To your point about that $60 kind of being sustainable to date, I mean, I think because games have kind of gotten into way more markets, and so as you know, that happens, obviously that can sustain itself, but that's not sustainable forever, like you said. But one of the other things that I thought was interesting too about games is, you know, you mentioned Xboxes, you know, the Xbox Series X or S, and then the PlayStation 5 being the last big powerhouses. Well, two things. One, people are walking around with incredible devices in their pockets every day.
Yeah.
But also make phone calls. You know, people don't use it from that so much, but they do a lot more than texting and Facebook. And so there's that. And like you mentioned, all of the thin clients, the thin architecture, I should say, the, you know, where you've got the Stadias, the Lunas, that is so incredible to see. And, you know, it's just, we need the physical infrastructure for that to work, right? Like real high speed internet across the country, and really across a lot of the markets that you want to play these games in. Otherwise that it doesn't work so well. But getting back to the AR point for a second, you mentioned something before in one of your talks a couple of years back and how you kind of saw AR being the next big push. I think it is as well, because I think there's so much you can do with it, especially now with, you know, object detection. But for and I want to take a step back, but for a while you were at Magic Leap. Yeah. And I couldn't get my hands on one of those first iteration Magic Leap devices, but I've seen the demos and absolutely stunning, incredible. Tell us what Magic Leap is.
Magic Leap is a spatial computing device that allows you to put basically photons into the room with you that exists upon a distance away from your eyeballs. It also has a series of sensors on it that add understanding to the environment around you. So in the current version of the operating system, it knows that, you know, you're in front of a desk and that this is a mouse and this is a TV, and it'll see these things, and it's you can query the operating system and say, what's around me? Look for a desk surface, look for a wall surface, look for these things, and then your program can go add context to those things. So the idea of spatial computing is the ability to go add virtual context to the world around me virtually. So adding things that aren't there to the world, but looking like they are belonging to the world. You just without being virtual reality.
Right. And that's the thing. Like it's not virtual reality. It's kind of like if virtual reality spilled into the real world.
Yes.
And that is the cool thing. And again, watching some of those demos, it's just, you know, blew my mind watching those. And I wanted one of those, couldn't get one. And I'm looking forward to when that there is another commercial, you know, release of that, you know. And again, I know some of the companies had some struggles this year, just like everybody else because of the coronavirus, but be it Magic Leap or Apple, as they're also rumored to be doing something with augmented reality headset. I really hope they don't use the Apple Glass, you know, term, just because of how miserable the Google Glass experiment failed. I've got one of those. is this the medium though that we should be expecting to kind of be developing in the future?
I think for me, I look at augmented reality as being starting out on the mobile device. I don't want to ignore the billions and billions and billions of phones out there. And especially even the $35 Android phone that's serving someone in, you know, a third country world, or even, you know, anywhere on the planet, all the way up to the $1,100 iPhone 12 Max Pro.
Right.
You know, there's quite a range of devices there, as well as the devices which are on the horizon. I think there's a need for, you know, when you're on augmented reality on a mobile device, on a phone, you're only providing one context. You're providing the context of just that application. So you're just adding one single application, which is all a mobile device does. I'm going to be in my Facebook, or I'm going to be in this augmented reality application, or I'm going to be doing this other, or you're playing Pokemon Go, or then back to Twitter. But when I put a headset on, when I put a pair of glasses on, I expect to be able to context switch very quickly between multiple things. I expect the Pokemon to be on the ground next to me and my Twitter feed to be on the desk next to me as well. And I expect, by looking at both, the context to be able to switch. That operating system does not yet exist. I don't know if Apple or Magic Leap or Google or anyone's actually working on that, because everyone, I think, is still converting the mobile device to the headset and thinking that's just fine. I don't think anyone's really thinking, it's really different experience when we move it from holding it in my hand to putting it in my eyeballs. And I think if I've learned anything from my 7 years at Magic Leap, it's that you can't just take a phone interface and stick it in stick it on your head. It's a very different environment. And yes, we made a wonderful dev kit at Magic Leap. It was an excellent dev kit, but it was still a single context device. And the true commercial device is contextless. And I think that's going to be the breakthrough that happens that really makes both gaming and us all wear the device every single day, all the time. And game designers want to go make worlds that happen constantly. And that's the really exciting place to go with games at in the future.
Awesome. That would be awesome, to see that. I just hope I'm alive when it happens.
I think we will be.
Well, like I said, I hope
so. Just bring on that vaccine. Come on.
That's what I'm talking about. I hope I make it. But, you know, and so we were talking before this, and you mentioned you've got a new venture. And again, you blew my mind, because I didn't know this was happening. And I was so excited. And you were like, can we talk about this? I was like, absolutely. Yes, let's definitely talk about this. You've got a new venture. It's called Quarantine Studios. And I just want to say, and I want you to explain it to us, but you've got a team assembled, and it's kind of like the video game production team equivalent to the Avengers almost, looking at everybody's CVs. What are you folks working on?
We're starting as Quarantine Studios. We're migrating into QXR as quarantine ends. But we kind of all met because for the last 18 months, I've been working with the Royal Shakespeare Company on a play, an augmented reality play, a version of Midsummer Night's Dream. And I thought my times as a game designer were kind of over, and I'm now a playwright. We were working on a 10-episode web AR introduction to a play happening in Stratford-upon-Avon. It was going to come out in June. And this is a redo of the Midsummer Night's Dream, and it introduced an alternative world version of the Shakespearean play. Fairies are real. They're called good fellows. You know, there's the Department of Agriculture is really kind of like looks after everything scientific. You know, mankind's never been to the moon, or all these things. And this 10-part episodic series introduced you to that world. And we were working on that. And sadly, it all got canceled because of the pandemic. But we were very excited about working on that and everything that we learned working on that as well, about going in and learning about how do we make episodic content. And that team was, the core team was also just fantastic to work with, and really, you know, we all grew close and just loved working together. So after we all got laid off from Magic Leap, and we all wanted to keep going. So that's the core of Quarantine Studios, is that core team still, as well as just a few others that we've met along the way, of just wanting to keep on having those kind of, that kind of content, build upon it and find what is the episodic content that we can make, be it, you know, that version of the Midsummer Night Dream, be it Metropolis, be it whatever episodic content that we make in AR, as well as for the desktop in AR, and find a way that the platform can start to flourish, so that it's not this free-to-play advertising thing that is just out there and no one is really paying attention to it because it's just a leprechaun flying off a beer can.
Yeah, and you mentioned, first of all, that story, the 10-part series story, just sounded amazing. And I was like, as you're telling me, I'm like, oh, where? And I'm like, my next question is going to be, where can I find this? yes. But as you're talking, and then you mentioned Metropolis, and it's like, again, another one of your games that we just don't have enough time to talk about. But Metropolis was another really cool adventure game that you worked on. And if that's the game that you're talking about kind of expounding on and making that into AR, oh my goodness. I think that is another one of those kinds of ideas for a killer, the must-have AR game. So whatever you do, I'm on board, man. So especially with that team of folks. And I'll put a link to QXR Studios in the show notes. And I encourage folks to be on the lookout for what they're doing, because man, the talent that's on that team, it's a can't miss. So long as the funding's all there, you can't miss.
I love the team. That was the thing. It's always about the team. I've learned over my years of making games of just team. You know, that's the only important thing. That's the thing that you want to wake up to every day, is people you want to work with. And so yes, that's basically what we all came to the set. We're all at the same conclusion at this point in our lives. And so that's why we are the Avengers.
and speaking of team, you also had a company called GRL Games, and you know, it's presumably stands for Giant Robot Lizard, you know, to kind of match along with the logo, but there's other, you know, implications for, you know, that it matches up with the initials of your family.
Yeah.
I mean, tell me, so that's also cool. And part of what you did there, you did a lot of card games and word tile games. And, you know, speaking of team, one of the people on your team was your daughter. So before I get into that, you've got like I said, there's a slate of these games. I'm going to put up on the show notes where folks can find these, because on the iOS platform, these are fantastic solitaire games, card games and word games. You know, Brian, if you're listening, Brian's my boss, Graham. If you're listening, a lot of the issues that I have getting stuff done on time sometimes, just a couple of times, is because Graham put Full Deck Solitaire online. So I don't need an iPad to kind of yes, start playing. So thanks, Graham. but what got you focused on doing some of the card games?
I actually left Apple to go make the next big adventure game, to go actually start on kind of Metropolis and start making that. And my wife and daughter were very persuasive that I should go make a solitaire game. And I'm Graham Devine, famous game designer. I don't make card games. And they were like, so sweet. You're so making a solitaire game. So I made a solitaire game. And it was actually the best thing I could ever do in the world. It's been the best game. It's been the most popular game I've ever made.
Really?
That's incredible. By far, it's had like 25 million downloads on them. Wow. But Rocky, my daughter, she would play test it, and she would come in with iPad in hand and say, "Dad, I think this feature is going to be too hard for you to program, but here's my idea." And of course, when your daughter says, "I think this is going to be too hard for you," that's then the 24-hour quest to prove your daughter wrong. And those were the best sprints. And then the best follow-up was I gave a GDC talk with her maybe 10 years ago now, maybe less, but she actually did a critique of all my games. So she actually went through each of my games from Seventh Guest through Clandestiny and criticized them from the perspective of a teenager.
Oh boy.
And so live on stage in front of thousands of people.
Did you get to see or did you read what she was going to say beforehand? Or
was
this all?
Okay. But she ad-libbed. As soon as she saw people laughing, she was ad-libbing away.
Oh, boy.
People were rushing up to the stage, giving her business cards, saying, "Will you critique my game? Will you critique my game? Will you critique my game?" And it was fabulous. That was probably the highlight of my career.
Oh, that's awesome. It sounds like she could have had a career in a YouTube channel or a TikTok channel critiquing games.
If that had been the thing at the time, I think definitely.
That's crazy. I've got two questions. So you said you spent some time at Apple. You know, for the folks listening, what were you working on at Apple when you were there?
Really, game technologies and helping Apple think about what games meant. So primarily my role was to help us, first of all, launch the iPad. That was the group I was helping launch the iPad. And then after that, focusing on helping game developers think about gaming on the on iOS devices. So a lot of telling people, if you add a virtual D-pad to your game, you're saying your game is better on a Nintendo 3DS or Sony PSP, which were the big platforms at the time. And they would say, "Graham, you are silly. Please, the virtual D-pad is so cool. Just add a joystick to your darn device." And there was even a lot of pressure from inside Apple to add joysticks to our devices. And I was like, "No, this is a beautiful touch interface. Wow. We have literally gotten on stage and showed how we touch photographs and email on the other side of a piece of glass. It's the same with games." And getting people over the joystick interface to games, and slowly we started to see games just start to change to touch and start to change to using touch interfaces and get to use those as their primary method of inputs and become successful that way. And it was kind of rewarding.
You can't have games like Angry Birds with a joystick. It just doesn't make sense, right? I mean,
no.
I think that probably the idea process behind something like that just doesn't happen if you've got a joystick, because those folks are like, "Okay, we've got a joystick. We can do so much other things. Let's stay traditional." So for the work that you've done on that, thank you so much. Because I actually, like I said, I published a couple of games on the Apple platform, and it's always incredibly hard to keep up with them, because every year you've got to make sure that you've maintained things. And so, as an indie developer who doesn't have a whole lot of downloads, it's kind of like, well, and again, I have that attitude where it's like, "Hey, I've shipped. I'm done. You know, I don't want to have to go back and update this. This is a moment in history." Okay. The other question I had for you is that, like I said, your daughter was helping you test and giving you feedback. Do you have advice to moms and dads out there that maybe want to steer their teens into tech or be part of their own tech projects? Or things to avoid if you're working with your children?
I think the reason I started GRL Games was, I saw in school that Rocky's school was aiming her towards a cubicle. And my deal was, it doesn't have to be a cubicle. It can be, you can be a sculptor, you can be a poet, you can be anything. And I wanted to show her you could be anything. So it didn't necessarily have to be tech. And I've done that throughout her, looking back on it, I've done it throughout her education. Back when she was in the first few grades at school, I started the computer class there. We did multimedia. So I bought in like the 8 Macs or whatever into the school, and we all learned how to use iMovie together. The whole school, and they're all 6 and 8 year olds, and it was terrible. But we made an iMovie, and slowly, week after week, they got better at iMovie, and the parents started to come in and also start to learn third iMovie. And by the end of it, we made this little iMovie together. And oh my God, 6 and 8 year olds don't want to learn. but you know, each just trying to stay involved at their level and don't try to bring it to my level, but try to learn what their level is and their involvement. And you know, don't just never force anything on anyone. That's you know, you will be a game designer. That's never going to achieve, you know, the goal of making a game designer. You know, I think being involved just with what you love, and just that's the thing that I try to do. I learned from Trilobites. At the end of Trilobites, it was very hard to lose the company. You know, 60 people worked for me, and the company was gone, and I put all my money back into it, and it was just gone. But at the end of it, I realized I had a wife and a daughter. 4-year-old daughter and wife of 6-7 years, and I didn't know either of them. My wife had her own friends, her own social circles. I hadn't really seen my daughter because I worked, you know, until 4 o'clock in the morning every day and back in the office by 9, and I didn't know them. And I thought to myself, this is the wrong way around. You can be successful. You can go make money. You can go build Trilobite. You can go make that. But the better thing is to know your family. The better thing is to go home and get to know your daughter, because you get to know your wife, get to know their friends, get to have friends. And that was the big lesson of Trilobite. So Trilobite failing was actually both the worst thing and best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah. I'm so happy that you shared that, because sometimes, you know, one, I'm also happy that you were able to kind of realize that, because sometimes people don't, and they kind of get stuck in the negative and not see the other side of that coin that gets flipped on them. But it's serious. Thank you for sharing that, because again, lots of folks don't see that. And there's so many cool things that have kind of come out of that, that you've experienced that and said, hey, look, this is a better way. Like I said, Full Deck Solitaire, your most successful game came out of that. So it's wild to see kind of where things go. And you know, I just want to make a point for folks listening who maybe are going through a really tough time or have that really strong feelings of imposter syndrome. Like, just, you know, work through it, you know, stick with it and see the positives where they are, and don't focus so much on the negative, and really try to see the positives and ride that wave. You never know where it's going to go.
Oh, I have terrible imposter syndrome still. I still have terrible trouble going to conferences like GDC or any kind of conference like that. I feel that I just don't even come up to any of the standards of any of the game developers there. I don't even begin to come close to any of them. And so it's very hard for me to get across that line to walk into any of the conferences.
And that's so crazy, because when those conferences happen, there are hundreds and hundreds of people who are looking forward to seeing you give your talks and present. So that's the thing I think folks need to understand, is that no matter how successful you are, it doesn't matter. It happens. And it's to deal with it. There's so many other coping mechanisms, but it happens to everybody. I mean, if it's happening to Graham Devine, it can happen to you. And just, you know, try to be positive, surround yourself with positivity, right? What do you do, Graham? What do you do to kind of get over those feelings?
I do two things. I have a dog that I walk a lot. so we do hikes, and we do, as she said, she's probably at the door right now wondering what's Graham doing. The other thing is I do is I meditate, and I sit and meditate, and I focus on a single place that I have. I have a meadow with a windmill in it, and I have that whole thing down to exactly how it looks, exactly how it feels, so I can form that in my mind. And I find that meditating on that actually helps me a lot. Just because it lets me walk away from everything. And it's that, by walking away from everything, it really helps. And the other thing I do is, you know, on Tuesdays is kind of my mentoring day. So I mentor people.
Oh, wonderful.
That's kind of, I go through and half-hour chats with people, and some of them every 2 weeks, some of them every week, and some of them become don't need mentoring anymore. I just continue to chat with them. That's but cool. It's because they've become better than me. That is also very inspiring for me to be able to go through and just, of course, it's not really mentoring. It's just a conversation, and it's just that let's have a chat. But it is kind of a good mentoring situation. I try to do that with Tuesday.
Yeah, giving back is another great way to get positive feelings. It's the best.
Yes,
it's just to give something of yourself to somebody and see them enjoy it and use it to just benefit themselves with nothing that you're going to gain out of it, just to help someone else. Fantastic. And I encourage everyone to do that. That's fantastic. I would not, like I said, it's one of those things where you go around and you see these successful folks and you say, there's no way these people deal with imposter syndrome. And then you realize, well, wait, they're just people too. And so why wouldn't they, right? Like what, you know, there's no amount of accolades that someone can have that it ever goes away. So, that's good to know. That's good to know. Graham, I'd like to ask some questions, to look back on your career just a bit, if that's okay with you.
Of course, yes.
All right. And I ask these questions to everybody, so it's kind of a nice way to kind of get a profile of folks. But so what have been some of the challenges that you've struggled coming up as a developer?
I think knowing when to just moving through this industry from, late 70s, 80s, 90s, that's perhaps a unique struggle for me is that back in the 80s, you were making everything. I was coding, art, sound. And it put me in a unique position to become an indie developer because, once again, dealing with kind of everything, but now hiring artists in Russia and all the things. But as the industry has changed, being able to change with it, back then, it was using two-dimensional sprites, moving to 3D, moving from assembly code to language, moving from C to C++, moving from C++ to Objective-C, moving from everything being one single piece of code to having a server component, moving to having many server components and a client component, and then a database and all the things that you have to learn along the way. It's never forgetting to stop learning. And you become very complacent that, I know everything. And then you realize you've never even come close to knowing everything. And I think as soon as you stop learning, that's kind of when it's time to, that's the bad time. So it's always keeping up on learning is kind of the struggle that you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause if you're not continuing to learn, then are you really in an industry or really at a job where you're interested in? Cause if you don't want to know more about it, then maybe it's something that's not for you. It resonated with me when you said going back, you doing everything. Cause I've done some video game development and at the indie level only, and you do everything from physics to then, okay, now you're also doing the music and the artwork and the marketing. So
it's, yes.
But it's such a fun thing to do. Okay. Getting back to you. What's something you wish you knew, when you were younger?
Oh my gosh, I thought about this and I'm still thinking. I think it was, it's probably that it's okay to leave something to the next day. Because I literally work until I dropped when I was younger. I would work through the night, every night. And I think I lost a lot of time with people, with friends. And that was much to the detriment of my own health as well, I think. And so I think that big lesson of it's okay to say, I'll finish this tomorrow, is a fine lesson in life of I'll finish this tomorrow. It'll still be there. And I think, it's still in the back of your mind when you walk away, but it's getting away from that keyboard is really important.
Yeah.
And I did not learn that lesson until it was probably too late.
It's great advice because sometimes, when you walk away, you let your brain kind of settle for a bit and those solutions kind of come in. out of nowhere. So, but that's fantastic advice for anyone listening to just walk away, to understand that there are other things in life and you can still love what you're doing, walk away and still come back and it'll still be there. You know, it may be a little late, but it'll still be there and you could still, you'll still be able to get that stuff done. And we talked a bit before about it, but I'm going to ask anyway, what's one thing that you do to escape and clear your mind from work?
Oh, World of Warcraft. The clear my mind stuff, you know, the get around problems, meditate, walk the dog, but clear my mind, World of Warcraft. I played that for the last 16 years and I still play that.
I love that game. I actually had to, there was a weekend once where I was playing that and then it was Friday night, got home from work. And before I knew it, it was Sunday morning. And said, look, this has to go. I had to put it in a drawer just like, no, you know, can't play this anymore for a while. But yeah, I love that. That was such a good, I mean, for me, it was such a great game to play, but you do get lost in it. And a lot of it's, you know, I played before a lot of the animals and the pets, but the walking, watching a 3D character walk is sometimes, well, maybe not sometimes, but for me at the time, it was just as meditative almost as going out for an actual walk. Cause you're just walking through Azeroth and there you go. Okay.
You're walking up and looking over the next hill. It's fun. And I actually play with my daughter. So it's, you know, the two of us, the level together and on all the expansions together. And,
very cool.
So it's been, but yeah, that's still my go-to. And, I just spend time there and, you know, new games come out and new games are sat wrapped. You know, I'm really looking forward to Cyberpunk 2077, but I'll probably still go play WoW a bunch and play through that.
I'm guilty of that as well. I think I've still got GTA 5 in the wrapper, but
yeah.
Okay. Graham, folks in our professions, we don't get a lot of opportunities to promote ourselves. Here's a chance for some self-promotion. What about yourself are you most proud of, love the most, or something about you that you use to inspire confidence in yourself?
Oh my goodness, that's actually, I actually really dislike self-promotion. I'm not a fan of it at all, and everyone tells me it's a horrible thing that I don't do it, that I should go do it more. So I
feel the same way, but the reason why I think it's important to do, not all of the time, but from time to time, is just to kind of understand that why are you, it's a great way to kind of overcome imposter syndrome. If you can say, hey, these are some things that I love about myself. You know, I'm able to have some more confidence when I talk to my boss. In other words, if I'm going to be able to buy what I'm selling, then so I should be able to sell it to my manager, my coworkers, et cetera.
Oh.
It's in that vein.
I have a series of life rules that I follow. And so my life rules are basically always take your birthday off, no matter what. Tell it to people, celebrate it. You only get 103 of them or whatever you get now. So always take your birthday off. You know, number two, don't be an asshole ever. You know, it's a simple rule, and it's, you know, just remember it in the back of your mind. Number three, don't press fast forward on Tom Petty or David Bowie ever. And insert your own idols right there.
Right.
And, you know, don't take my idols. That's bad.
I'm loving these rules, by the way.
What's number four? But you know, I just was. And so I'll post these to, you know, actually, if you want to self-promote, go follow me on Twitter, you know, safepodgjb, where I post pictures of both my dog and thoughts on life in general. And you can, you know, DM me if you've got questions and I'll generally answer.
I can attest to that.
So, you know, that's, you know, I love to interact with people. So that's my kind of professional social is right there. And I encourage you to just go get my thoughts on life. And if you like them, follow. If you don't like them, you can unfollow me. That's fine.
That's awesome. I'd love to see those rules in a tweet somewhere, just so I could print it out and hang it on my wall. Those are great rules. They're great rules. Graham, you've been a delight. Thank you. So I hope you had some fun hanging out today.
Of course. Thank you for having me. Yes, it's been great.
It's like I said, just, you know, for someone like me, like, you know, and I'm going to get more into me instead of more into you, obviously, then this is, I apologize for that. But, you know, I went to school and I went to my senior thesis and I said, look, I want to make a video game. And my friend here and I were going to do the video game as our thesis. And my professor said, no, that's not a project. You've got to do something with a database and something else. And I said, wait, what? Like, what are you talking about? And I went and I showed him Andre Lamothe's book on how to do DirectX programming. This was 10 years ago. Oh, no, sorry. This is 20 years
ago. Yeah, longer. Yeah.
And I showed him and I had to convince him. And we finally convinced him to let us do it. And we created this one single level game called Alex in Demented Land. Created all the characters in Poser. Animated. We animated it with 2D sprites, but they were 3D renders. So kind of like a very claymation or clay fighter look to it. And, you know, so since then, and, you know, here's an, you know, why is it that game developers always use the giant ham as the health? I don't know. Why do we do that? Why do folks do that?
Because the Red Cross will sue you if you use a Red Cross.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other one. So we did that and it was just a wild thing. And, that's what got me to love it. And except I didn't know anybody in the game development community. So I just said, look, you know, and this was way before the internet got popular, you know, with Twitter and social media. So I just said, okay, well, I'll go into banking and that's where I'll, you know, be able to have a paycheck. And it wasn't until your talk in 2011 where I was like, you know, I've got to stop doing this. And so I had walked away from my job before and I kind of said, look, let's take a break for a little bit. And that's when I started doing games after your talk. So I thank you so much for that inspiration there.
That's an incredible story. That is absolutely incredible. Yep.
Thank you.
That is wonderful.
So folks, like I said, Graham will, if you ask him a question on Twitter, he probably will get back to you and answer you. So, cause like I said, I feel so stupid now cause I actually sent you a promo code and I was like, here's a promo code for my dollar game, you know, play it. And this is a different game. This is a mobile game, but, you know, it's so silly, but, anyway,
I think I actually bought your game. I didn't think I actually used the promo code. I think I actually bought it cause I do like to, you know, You got the 70 cents from me.
Oh, geez. I'm so embarrassed now.
I
thank you for that. I do thank you for that. I don't know where to go from here. Okay. So we'll end the show here. So Graham, thank you so much for being a guest today. You've been a delight.
And for folks out there that are interested in hearing more from Graham, you can follow him on Twitter at ZaphodGJD. You can check out Full Deck Solitaire online for free, and links to all of Graham's other GRL games are over at grlgames.net. And if you like AR or you just want to keep up with Quarantine Studios, they're online at qxrstudios.com and on Twitter at qxrstudios. As always, links to everything will be available in the show notes. Thanks again, Graham, and thank you all for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if you are subscribed, I'd love to hear back from you. You can email me at hello@friendsthatcode.com. And with that, tell your friends, because next week I'll be back again with another amazing person that just happens to write code for a living. Until then, be well, everyone.